This is chapter 3 in our continuing project in relation to the race riots in Wales in 1919. Chapter 23, Bolshevism, the thing the Allies feared. The Russian Revolution was a period of political and social revolution across the territory of the Russian Empire, commencing with the abolition of the monarchy in 1917 and concluding in 1923 after the Bolshevik establishment of the Soviet Union, which included the national states of Ukraine, Azerbaijan and others, and the end of the Civil War. The final collapse of the Russian monarchy began during the First World War with the February 1917 revolution that was focused in and around Petrograd, which is now St. Petersburg, and at the time was the capital of Russia. This revolution erupted in the context of Russia's major military losses during the war, which resulted in much of the Russian army being ready to mutiny. In the chaos, members of the Duma, Russia's parliament, assumed control of the country, forming the Russian Provisional Government. This was dominated by the interests of large capitalists and the noble aristocracy, even though the monarchy had lost control. Grassroots community assemblies called Soviets, which were dominated by soldiers and the urban industrial working class, initially permitted the Provisional Government to rule. But the Bolsheviks, led by Vladimir Lenin, gained substantial influence in the Soviets. Lenin campaigned for an immediate end of Russia's participation in the war, granting land to the peasants and providing bread to the urban workers. When the Provisional Government chose to continue fighting the war with Germany, the Bolsheviks and other socialist factions used that to advance the revolution further. The term Bolshevik, by the way, comes from the Russian word bolshinstvo, which means majority. The Bolsheviks ultimately became the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. The Bolsheviks, or Reds, came to power in Russia during the October Revolution phase of the Russian Revolution of 1917, and they founded the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic, RSFSR. The derogatory terms we often now hear for workers come from the West's feeling about that group. Terms such as Bolshe, workers, red, or pinkos. The revolutions of 1917 to 1923 were a revolutionary wave that included political unrest and revolts around the world, inspired by the success of the Russian Revolution and the disorder created by the aftermath of World War I. The uprisings were mainly socialist or anti-colonial in nature. Many attempted socialist revolts failed to have a long-term impact. The Bolsheviks actively sought to encourage and support these revolts, including active participation in the British trade unions via the Communist Party. Many French soldiers mutinied in 1917 and refused to engage the enemy. In Bulgaria, many troops mutinied and the Bulgarian Tsar stepped down. Mass strikes and mutinies occurred in Austria, Hungary, and the Habsburg monarchy, and it collapsed. In Germany, the November Revolution of 1918 threatened to overtake Germany, but eventually failed because the army decided to support the government. Italy faced various mass strikes. Greece succumbed to a coup d'etat in 1922. Turkey experienced a successful war of independence. Across the world, various other protests and revolts occurred from the turmoil of World War I and the success of the Russian Revolution. Now, in the UK, the trade union, Triple Alliance, was a real concern for the British government. they felt strongly that the unions were being affected by Bolsheviks within. Before the war, the mines, railways and docks had been privately owned, but in 1914, under a threat of war, they were nationalised. This meant in 1919, the three most powerful groups of workers, the Triple Alliance, were actually working for the state. Now, these workers had been receiving a bonus during the war and had increased their working hours, but the wages were reduced in 1919. In February 1919, the three union leaders, the lead union leaders from the three main Triple Alliance groups, that's coal, rail, transport and docks, were invited to 10 Downing Street to have tea with Prime Minister Lloyd George. Strikes had doubled after the war across all industries, including teaching, and the government could not be sure the army would suppress action. After all, the army itself had succumbed to various mutinies. According to the miners' representative, according to one of the delegates, Robert Smiley, which was confirmed by Aniram Bevan, the Prime Minister said the following to them: "Gentlemen, you have fashioned in the Triple Alliance a most powerful instrument. I feel bound to tell you that in our opinion we are at your mercy. The army is disaffected and cannot be relied upon. In these circumstances, if you carry out your threat and strike, then you will defeat us. But if you do so, have you weighed the consequences?" Robert Smiley was the General Secretary of the Transport Workers' Federation. His argument was simple and clear at a time when states were near collapse across Europe. If the unions won, the state and government would collapse. So would the Triple Alliance be ready for a collapse of authority that meant they would effectively be in charge, be the government? At that point, the leaders of the unions were made fully aware that if they wanted Bolshevism, it was theirs. But this was not a vision they wanted. They were simply negotiating for better conditions and wages, and their positions rested on their relationship with government and employers. So they went back to their unions, not wanting the government to collapse. The railway workers had demanded a strike by March. The railway executive had refused the National Union of Railway Workers' demands, prompting the union's special general meeting, SGM, to express its, quote, utmost disgust, unquote, and to vote 43-19 to ask the Triple Alliance partners to support a national strike. But the NUR leaders were not keen on this course of action, and together with the transport and miners' union leaders, decided against the national strike. Instead, they met the minister, Bonner Law, who made some concessions to the railwaymen, guaranteed working hours, minimum rest period, and a week's paid holiday. On the 27th of March, the NUR special general meeting voted 41-19 not to go ahead with strikes because of progress in talks, a phrase familiar to rail union members to this day. Those talks would continue for 6 months while a government prepared to defeat the inevitable strike, but the union leaders prepared to avoid it rather than win it. Like the NUR, the Miners' Federation let the government persuade it to postpone action. Lloyd George appointed the Sankey Commission to investigate working conditions and ownership of the coal industry, promising to implement its findings. After a preliminary report on 20th of May, the Sankey report delivered its full verdict on 20th of June, favouring nationalisation, a 20% pay rise and 1 hour off the miners' working day. A month later, the government had taken only one measure, announcing that the maximum time that miners would work underground would be cut from 8 to 7 hours. The Miners' Federation did not act. still trusting the government to honour the Sankey report. But rank and file members were not so naive and patient. In mid-July, an unofficial strike spread from Kent and South Wales to Staffordshire, Derbyshire, Yorkshire, the North East and Scotland. But without the support of their union, who held strike funds, the strikes came to an end in mid-August. However, none of this helped black people, because the unions wanted their jobs, and they were a useful target for disillusioned workers. One of the reasons there was not enough work was the high number of strikes crippling an already damaging economy. The relatively few jobs taken by black people would have made little difference to the high level of post-war unemployment. However, the fear of them being radicalised was a different matter for the government. For that reason, controlling them and removing them was something the government was in favour of. The problem was the legislative position made that difficult. They were British citizens. But in an environment where the press placed the blame fully upon black people, the riots provided the smokescreen of public demand. This smokescreen would be commonly used from 1919 onward by the British government.